is the Victorian Country Hour with Warwick Long on ABC Radio Victoria.
Good afternoon, Warwick Long with you for the Country Hour today, where we'll head overseas to the small nation of Lebanon, which has had a lot of its agriculture wiped out as fighting continues in the Middle East. More on that is coming up. Australian farmers are also concerned about legislation in the European Union, particularly the wool industry, and we'll give you some details on that as a weekend deadline looms as well. Plus, I'm going to need your help today on the program, particularly on what your favourite farm field days are. And this isn't a Victoria thing. I want you thinking Australia-wide. That and a whole lot more coming up today on The Country Hour. I'd love to continue that conversation today. In fact, many of you may know on social media, I have been known for a poll or two, particularly about agriculture, particularly about Australian culture over the years, notably looking at our favourite big things, our favourite breeds of cattle, our favourite breeds of sheep. I'm going to start a poll probably this weekend around our favourite farm field days. Probably a vote, starting with about 32 field days around Australia, and we'll decide the best. So, text line today, what are the best field days in Australia you have ever been to? 0467 842 722. You can call as well, 1300 977 222. Just answer that question. Tell me a little bit about why. What are the best field days in Australia? And if you're sending one in because you organise it, you better put that detail in the text as well. Let's keep talking about biosecurity, though, as we have been a lot of this week, as the Senate has been investigating legislation around who should pay for biosecurity protections in Australia. Honey producers say a proposed biosecurity levy would be another burden for their industry on top of historically low honey prices and the outbreak of the bee-killing varroa mite. The Australian Honeybee Council spoke at a Senate hearing this week to discuss how a $50 million biosecurity levy would affect their producers. Here's CEO Danny Lefebvre responding to a question, well, questions from LNP Senator Matt Canavan.
What's your understanding of how the levy would be collected from your members?
Senator, for the honeybee industry, the indications we've received is it would be also collected through the existing collection methods, which also presents some challenges for our industry. Our current collection method really only focuses on our commercial beekeepers, which is only about 2,000 beekeepers operating across the country. We now have some 47,000 recreational beekeepers in the honeybee industry now who are not being captured under the current levy collection system. And by imposing this new levy and utilising the existing collection methodology, we're likely just to exacerbate that problem that we've got in our industry.
So just on that last point about the recreational honeybee industry, is their output included in the gross value of production figures that generates the allocation to your industry?
We haven't seen how they're going to calculate the GVP for our industry, but generally when we do calculate our GVP for our industry, it does include the gross honey production, and it's not segregated between whether they're recreational or commercially produced honey. Right. It generally comes under the same cap.
Is that because of the data that's collected by ABS or what have you? It's just honey. It's sold as honey. It's not classified as commercial or recreational.
Yeah, correct. It's very difficult to collect the data. The data points at the moment are collected from commercial packers who process the honey and sell it directly. But there's a lot of beekeepers now selling direct to consumers through farmer markets and those sort of things too. So we're likely to see a lot of beekeepers that are missed in the system because they're going direct to consumers and not through the traditional supply chain.
I mean, just so it's clear in my head, what I'm taking from your points here is that at least some of the production from the recreational industry goes into your to the broad honey gross value production figure. That's the figure that is then used to allocate the $50-odd million that the government wants to collect through this levy. But given the current arrangements, and I presume also just administratively, that amount is then going to be concentrated and only collected on from the commercial beekeepers, even though the production of the recreational beekeepers has at least in some way inflated that figure.
Yes, correct.
Mm. Has that point been raised with the government? And if so, what was their response?
We have raised it directly, and the response we received is we've been working with them with the levy reform bill that's before government now, and we're really focused or hopeful that gets through Parliament to be able to utilise that, which will give us some more options to provide a more equitable way of collecting our levies. But at this stage, we're in a holding pattern waiting for that bill to go through.
So what's that? Is that before the Parliament? Excuse my ignorance. Is that before?
Yes, so the levy reform bill is before Parliament at the moment. It'll allow us to provide a levy on honey, but also on pollination services.
Is there any indication the government will ensure that bill goes through either before or at the same time as the biosecurity protection levy bill?
I've had no assurances from the government, no.
Okay. And look, just finally to yourself, Mr. Lefevre, the Varroa mite situation, I presume your members it's come at some cost, the response. Do you have a figure for the total cost of that and biosecurity response? Contributions?
Yeah, absolutely. So the agreed upper limit at the moment, Senator, is $100 million for the response. That's cost shared across all the parties, including berries being one of those. Cost sharing and strawberries. For our industry, it's $1.1 million. And we've just agreed to go through the process of increasing our levy by 1 cent a kilogram of honey sold. And that's in the face of an industry at the moment that's facing significantly low honey prices. We're seeing very cheap imports coming into the country. We're seeing climatic issues, and we're in a bit of disarray at the moment with Varroa as well. So it's just the wrong time for our industry to then be slapping them with another levy on top of what we're already having to pay back for the response.
That is Danny Lefevre, their CEO of the Australian Honeybee Council, saying $1.1 million is what the honeybee industry is paying right now for Varroa mite management. Green Senator Peter Whish-Wilson put this figure to Department Deputy Secretary of Biosecurity and Compliance, Justine Saunders. Here's that exchange about what the bee industry is paying and what is known about Varroa mite management.
With Varroa mite, for example, I think it's fair to say it's been the most significant biosecurity outbreak we've seen in recent years. It's cost over $100 million based on evidence we've received today. Yet this Senate committee has now had two inquiries into this, and we still haven't received any information as to what was the source of this significant outbreak, which is the role of border security, and that's what we're looking at better funding now. Do you agree that wouldn't inspire primary producers with confidence when we can't even say what has caused that outbreak?
Senator, I can appreciate that might be an interpretation taken by industry, and all I can do is assure you that that particular investigation of the matter is certainly forefront of my mind, and in fact I only spoke to the team that's been looking into that matter just this week, and whilst this might not be any consolation, this is complex, as this committee knows. There are international aspects to this, and once you start engaging the international domain, unfortunately, it does slow things down. And I guess the observation I make is that whilst we might have theories and supposition in regards to the source, I don't have the evidence to be able to, you know, publicly state the source at this point in time. But I certainly hope to do so at the earliest opportunity.
So it's still unknown in terms of the source of the Varroa mite outbreak in Australia. That was Department of Agriculture Deputy Secretary of Biosecurity and Compliance Justine Saunders speaking to the Green Senator Peter Whish-Wilson. There, it's 14 past 12 here on the Country Hour. I'm asking you today, what's your favourite farm field day and why? I'm going to hold a vote on that. I would love to know exactly where the good ones are. Anthony Coleraine says, "G'day Warwick, the Hamilton Sheepvention should win the field day competition by the length of the straight. Should almost win for best name. Sheepvention is one of the greatest names, Anthony. I'll agree with you on that." Another text here saying, "Sungold Field Days, too bad it got shut down." Sungold Field Days, I never got there. Always wanted to. I remember Libby, one of the previous Country Hour presenters out there a long time ago, sounding like she was having a great time. I wish I got there. Not around anymore. I did get to Stanhope Field Days, though. They're not around anymore either, but I was glad I made it before it finished. Kylie from Daysdale says, "Hi, Woz. Henty Machinery Field Days. Reason for me being close to Albury Wodonga. And the people are very friendly." Yes, Kylie, I've heard there's a lot of good people there at the Henty Machinery Field Days. But thank you for putting that one on the list. Doesn't have to be Victoria. Can definitely be New South Wales like Henty. Could be somewhere else. Where are the best farm field days in Australia? Send us a text 0467 842 722. We'll go further afield than Australia right now, though, because market access into Europe for natural fibres like wool and cotton is threatened by a labelling system that's being voted on shortly. And the wool industry is calling on Australians to make urgent submissions to try and get it rejected. Public consultation on the Product Environmental Footprint, or PEF, rules for apparel and footwear is closing on Sunday in Europe. National Wool Brokerage Manager for Fox & Lily, Amon Timms, told David Claughton people need to urgently make submissions to the European Parliament if they want to have better market access for wool for his industry.
The legislation for the PEF is in relation to fibres relying on the Higg Index, and the Higg Index is not at all friendly to natural fibres, so it doesn't take into account things like microplastic pollution, and so we're seeing if this PEF legislation doesn't include microplastics as a driver, and it's something that we're all seeing is a big issue now, then that's a huge miss in the opinion of natural fibre people like ourselves. Also, end of life. Obviously, it's much easier to recycle cotton and wool and natural fibres, and they will biodegrade naturally. Obviously, we see, you know, hundreds of thousands of tons of synthetic clothing going into landfill every day of every week of every year.
Is there an argument here that actually the wool industry does have to do better on some of these sustainability measures?
The synthetic fibre industries have enormously deep pockets. So we don't have the deep pockets that they have. We need to do whatever we can. I think this is the important way that we can hopefully swing the dial in our own favour and what we believe is a logical, should be a logical outcome to this.
So the Higg Index, it does look at things like greenhouse gases and water scarcity, water contamination. The wool industry is a bit exposed in some of those areas, aren't they, because of methane emissions from sheep?
That's correct. Having spoken to someone who's a bit of an expert in that area last year, he said to me there's whole factors of that methane equation that aren't taken into account, like at ground level when, and a lot of the methane comes from the burping, and that burping when they've got the head down and actually eating, a lot of the biosphere at that ground level actually takes that carbon and use it in the growing process. But in the calculations that are done on greenhouse gases, they just assume that the whole lot goes straight up, which it doesn't.
It's a bit of a perverse outcome in a way. And there's a big gap, isn't there? Like the Higg Index has wool producing 81 somethings per kilo and polyester's impact is 36. So wool well over double the impact of polyester. So it's hard to kind of understand that result.
Look, it seems, as I say, like a lot of these things, quite counterintuitive. It surprises us, put it that way. And wool and cotton and other natural fibres are being pushed to the edge because they're not taking account of some of the big issues that occur with synthetic fibres.
So why hasn't the Higg Index been revised? Because this was an issue some 3 years ago, I seem to recall. Can't they alter the index if it's not really an accurate reflection of what's actually going on?
Well, if you look at who owns the Higg Index, it's actually funded by people who are involved in the synthetic fibre industry. So what's the incentive for them to change that particular methodology? And so if the EU is going to take that on board as part of their framework, then we have part of the framework which we believe is in fact not reflective of reality.
So you're issuing basically a call to arms because there's a deadline looming for people to provide some feedback to this process. What do you want people to do about it?
So the Make the Label Count, which is funded significantly by Australian Wool Innovation and Cotton Australia and a number of other natural fibre industries, plus some mills, and they have been lobbying on our behalf in Brussels, and they have put together a sheet that people, an Excel spreadsheet that people can submit, and that will count as a vote in our favour, if you like. So if people want...
Does that make a difference? I mean, if you had a few hundred wool growers in Australia saying we don't want this thing to go forward. Are they really going to consider that?
From discussions I've had with some people in Europe, they believe that if it was over 1,000, it would be very, very seriously considered. A couple of years ago, we had great support for our industry in this whole issue by the Norwegian government, because they actually stopped a number of fashion companies selling garments in Norway who were claiming environmental credentials based on the Higg Index, and the Norwegian government had the gumption to stand up and say, you cannot make claims like that in our market because we do not believe the veracity of the Higg Index to make those claims.
So, and if you fail here and the legislation goes through, what impact could that have in Australia on the wool industry?
Well, it's all to do with market access, David. So in Europe, with all products, they will be given ratings. So on the traffic light system, if you like, if wool ends up on the red light end of the spectrum and synthetic garments end up on the green light end of the recommendation to consumers, we don't believe that's a good outcome for them or for us.
That is Amon Timms from Fox and Lily speaking there to David Claughton, wanting people to make a submission before the end, well, before Sunday, when they close on Sunday. I think wool at flrural.com.au is an email address that they are asking for growers to basically get together before putting in their requests there. It's 21 past 12 here on the Country Hour. Warwick along with you. We'll stay overseas right now. Yesterday on the program, we had a good look at Anzac Day and the legacy of war and agriculture in Australia with the Women's Land Army, also talking about the history of woolen mills in Australia as well. Today, we'll talk about conflict that's continuing even now in the Middle East and spreading beyond Gaza. Agriculture is in the firing line in the Middle East in nearby Lebanon, where food supplies are becoming stretched. Missiles have been traded between Israel and Hezbollah militia in Lebanon's south for over 6 months. And many farmers have been forced to leave their fields in southern Lebanon, one of the country's biggest food production areas, due to hostilities between the countries. But as Fiona Broom reports, many now in Lebanon who were already facing extreme hunger are now facing an even greater risk.
If you overlay Lebanon on a map of Australia, it would only just cover Greater Melbourne. The tiny Mediterranean country lies between Syria to the north and east and Israel to the south. As hostilities with Israel have increased over the past 6 months, farmers and villagers have left their land along Lebanon's southern border. It's the latest in a series of challenges. Lebanon spiralled into political crisis in 2019 and the currency, the lira, plummeted in value. Then came conflict between Ukraine and Russia, which sent the price of staple foods skyrocketing. Food security and nutrition specialist Professor Lara Nasruddin says this all meant many people were already facing food crisis in Lebanon before war returned to the south.
The recent hostilities come already in a situation where Lebanon is facing its worst socioeconomic crisis. So we're already having a big number of vulnerable population. We already have decreased food security in the country. So the ongoing hostilities with Israel had the potential impact on the displaced population itself. But it also had an impact on food production because the agriculture sector has been really hit hard.
Missiles have been traded between Israel and the Hezbollah militia in Lebanon's south over the past 6 months. Investigations by organisations like Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch and media outlets such as the Washington Post have concluded Israel has used white phosphorus bombs in southern Lebanon. Under international law, white phosphorus can be used on the battlefield and as a smokescreen, but cannot be used in civilian areas. Israel said its military and security, quote, complies and goes beyond the requirements of international law, end quote, and denies targeting civilians. White phosphorus is a toxic chemical that ignites when exposed to the air. Professor Nasruddin says it can contaminate crops and have long-term impacts on soils and waterways.
More than 60,000 of olive trees have been burned. Bananas and citrus, which represent one of the basic and maybe the cheapest type of fruits available for the population. Not only that, but the potential contamination that happened to other fields. So we have levels of heavy metals that have been reported at 900 times the normal amount. In a study from the States, it took 24 years to clean up lands from white phosphorus. So imagine the environmental impact that this will have on the agricultural production from these areas. And again, Lebanon already has very limited food production. We rely 80% on imports. And this is becoming difficult given the socioeconomic crisis. So if already what we are producing gets, you know, either burnt or contaminated, this will put us at a higher risk of food insecurity and particularly the most vulnerable population groups.
How much food does the southern part of Lebanon contribute to that 20% of food that is produced within the country? Is it a high production area?
Yeah, so I would say maybe around half would be produced from the agricultural areas in the south. So it does have a major contribution to the agricultural production in Lebanon.
Are people leaving the south of Lebanon, are farmers leaving the south of Lebanon?
So in the villages that are very much close to the Israeli border, yes, people are leaving. If you want, in terms of numbers, 90,000 individuals are now considered internally displaced. So amongst these, definitely, there are farmers. Many of these people who live in the towns and the villages that are close to the border actually rely on their own agricultural land, on their own food production to make a living. And their displacement will definitely have the most severe impact on their livelihood because their source of income and their source of food has disappeared. And this is really the majority of the people who have been displaced. You're talking about a portion of the population who is already vulnerable because agricultural activities and farmers in general, they make a living, but they're not, you know, very comfortable from a financial or economic perspective. And these now have lost all sorts of income. Not only income, the food that they usually eat themselves, they don't have access to it. So they're relying on aid from here and there, but this does not mean that they are in a situation that is food secure or at least nutrition secure. They might be eating food, but that is not providing them with all the needed nutrients. And the displacement of farmers does not affect them only as individuals, but it also affects the whole agricultural chain in the country.
When I think back to the beginning of the conflict in Syria, I remember learning that a lot of seasonal workers would come from Syria into Lebanon to help with the harvest. What's happened with that situation now? Does Lebanon have the labor it needs in its agricultural sector?
So this, again, because of the Syrian war, things have changed and there is no need for them to come seasonally because they are here. We have a very big proportion of refugees. So many of these refugees, the Syrian refugees, work in the agricultural sector. So we do have the manpower, and actually this is not a problem. We have the opposite problem whereby the big number of refugees is also causing a strain on the economic system. So if you want from the agricultural perspective, the answer is yes, because of the presence of Syrian refugees and a very big majority of these work in the agricultural sector. So this is not a problem. But maybe most of also, as the Lebanese have been displaced from the villages in the south, these Syrian refugees also might have been displaced and left, you know, the settlements that they are living in from the south. So the south villages have been directly hit because the farmers left, and most probably also the Syrian refugees have left because of safety concerns.
There are around 1.5 million Syrians now living in Lebanon. Professor Nasreddin says most are relying on aid for survival. A recent assessment by global hunger groups found more than 600,000 Lebanese are facing acute food insecurity, more than 1.5 million are food stressed. And around 26% of the country's Palestinian population is also in crisis or emergency. Lebanon's total population is around 6 million. This means the majority of people are struggling to access or afford food.
And again, in numbers, half the Lebanese population is considered below the poverty line, is living below the poverty line, more than half of the Lebanese population. I'm talking Lebanese, I'm not talking Syrian refugees. And this proportion of the half will basically include people who live in rural areas and villages who rely on agricultural activities. And it would include definitely people living in the southern villages relying on these agricultural activities.
And we have seen an escalation of hostilities within the region. How concerning is this from a food security perspective?
What we are worried about and very anxious about is whether this thing would escalate into a full-blown war. If it's regional, Lebanon will definitely be dragged into that. So the full-blown war will not have only an impact on agricultural activities and food production within the south, which is already disrupting the whole agricultural chain within the country. But a full-blown war will have even a bigger impact because Lebanon relies, 80% of the food we consume in Lebanon is imported. And a full-blown war would definitely disrupt also the food imports into the country. So it will really raise a big question mark on food security and food sovereignty in the sense that we may not be able to import through the port or through the airport. So yes, there are threats and there are concerns. The whole food system would become unstable in this situation.
Lebanese cuisine has a rich history and it's known around the world. But Professor Nasreddin says food is increasingly becoming inaccessible and unaffordable in Lebanon.
This is a very big problem in Lebanon because it might have worsened a little bit because of the hostilities, but the situation started in 2019 where we had the socioeconomic crisis. And this is why the food price has actually increased in a manner that is shocking. As of June 2023, Lebanon recorded the second highest food price inflation in the world, with a nominal food price inflation rate of 280%. So many people, a big proportion, more than 50%, cannot afford to buy food and definitely cannot afford to purchase the food that they want to eat. They might be relying on things that are a staple food, that are poor in nutrition, but that are more affordable just to sustain and to combat hunger.
That's Professor Lara Nasreddin from the American University of Beirut, ending that report from Fiona Broom, looking at Lebanese agriculture and what's happening there as war continues in the Middle East. Let's get some rural news right now. Jane McNaughton can give you that rural news today. Hi, Jane.
Good afternoon, Woz. Australia's competition watchdog, the ACCC, says it will not oppose Metcash Trading Limited's proposed acquisition of wholesale food distributor Superior Food Services. Superior is a privately owned food services distributor and supplies a wide range of dry, chilled, frozen meat, small goods and seafood lines to food service businesses in all states and territories in Australia, excluding the Northern Territory. It trades under Superior Food Services, Moolara River Fisheries, Kay's Meats, Global Meats and Celanese. Metcash is one of the biggest small players in the supermarket industry with IGA and Foodland businesses, but it also owns wholesaler Campbell's. The ACCC says although both Metcash and Superior supply food products, market feedback indicates that they do not compete closely for customers. Welsh farmers are accusing their government of becoming beef barons as it enforces a tough stance on eradicating bovine tuberculosis. Bovine TB is an infectious disease that affects farm animals such as cattle and pigs and wild mammals like badgers, foxes and deer. An infected animal may go undetected for months, but ultimately the disease is fatal. Farmers have recently protested that the government is mandating the killing of livestock but not managing the spread of disease in wildlife. Farmers Steve Walsh and Gareth Wynne-Jones say it's hurting their industry.
Let's not beat around the bush. It's horrific. You can't continue down the route of testing and culling livestock without testing and culling wildlife.
Right.
There's, you can't dress it up any other way.
No.
In amongst all of this, Welsh government are rapidly becoming the biggest beef barons in the UK by a mile with the number of animals they're killing. Because you have to also have to remember that that meat goes into the food chain. They test those animals, they're positive, they go into the abattoir, bang, wallop, they're dealt with. They're post-mortemed in the abattoir.
Yeah.
And as long as the carcass isn't riddled, that goes into the food chain.
Yeah.
So Welsh Government, yes, they pay us the compensation for the animal, not for the loss of income of the animal.
No. And you're taxed on that as well. People forget that, you know.
Vet nurses say that Australia's veterinary industry is under huge pressure and it's taking its toll. Increasing expectations by animal owners combined with staff shortages and cost of living pressures are having a detrimental effect on those working in clinics across the country. WA-based consultant and veterinary nurse Erica Honey says that a lot of the problems in the industry can be seen in the numbers of people actually doing the job.
We have about 125,000 human doctors to look after around 26 million Australians. 2024 data states we've got around 303,000 registered nurses, plus enrolled nurses and midwives. But then if you look at the patient load for veterinary, we've got 30.4 million pets cared for by only 13,500 vets approximately, and then 12,600 veterinary nurses.
Gin is an incredibly popular spirit in Australia, but did you know the main ingredient to make it, juniper berries, are mostly imported? Now a local grower is leading a mission to get more homegrown juniper berries in Australia gin. Lucy Vincent is a Snowy Mountains farmer growing juniper, which she supplies to a distiller in the Bega Valley to make gin. She wants to see more farmers get on board to support the production of the pure Australian-made gin on a bigger commercial level.
Most Australian artisan gins that are made, which are awesome, but most of them are made with juniper that comes from overseas, so Italy, Bulgaria, Greece, Macedonia, those places. There are three gins in Australia that are made with Australian juniper only. And so I want to change that. I want there to be more so that consumers can actually honestly see the provenance of what they're tasting.
Now, Warwick, let's head off to the US state of Louisiana, where there are almost 1 million alligators being raised on farms. But none of those alligators, that's right, none, are fed meat. Nathan Wall, who has farmed alligators in Louisiana for nearly four decades, says the United States alligator industry has moved to feeding their livestock purely with soy-based pellets.
Yeah, so we actually feed as much as 13 times a week, twice a day, and then a lot of farms feed once on Sunday. They fed likely better than most people in America because they get fed so many times. But it's an extruded pellet, and what the companies have done, some of the feed companies of what they've been able to create, is what is a necessary nutrients for the crocodilians, which is alligators for the United States.
Do any farms feed their alligators meat?
None whatsoever. We literally very familiar with all the farms. The entire United States probably produces maybe a total of 350,000 production a year, and no one feeds meat back to the alligators. We created a veggie pellet for the alligators, and that way there's no meat fed back to them. So it's pretty cool.
Vegetarian gators. Who'd have thunk it? That's today's Rural News Was.
And given their soy base, they could even be vegans. Jane McNaughton, thank you very much for that. You never would have guessed when it came to alligators and what they were fed, that they're on soy-based pellets. But I could listen to that Louisiana bloke talk about crocodilians all day. You could also listen to Stephanie Miles talk about the weather, and we'll do that right now. A senior forecaster at the Weather Bureau. G'day, Stephanie.
Oh, thanks, Warwick. How are you?
Yeah, good, good. How are we looking today?
I mean, today it feels very similar to what we had yesterday. So, I mean, it's pretty settled across the state, to be honest. There's a lot of cloud in the south and a lot of clear sky in the north, and we're kind of just remaining in that southwesterly airflow still today with a couple of showers, mostly in that southwest and eastern Gippsland area. But I mean, apart from that, it feels like a very nice little day across the state. Hopefully those people in the north getting quite a bit of sunshine as well. But look, over the weekend, we've got very settled conditions continuing. We've got a high-pressure ridge over us at the moment. The centre of it will move over the state throughout the weekend, which means our winds kind of start to drop off. Tomorrow on Saturday, our temperatures climb maybe 1 or 2 degrees. We're in the high teens, low 20s around the state. But look, the morning should see quite a lot of fog, quite widespread in the south and southeastern parts of the state. There's a bit of cloud around in the west and in the south, so expect maybe the temperatures to drop out just a little bit in the northern parts and we see a little bit of frost perhaps along our Victorian and New South Wales border. But apart from that, it looks like by the afternoon we will get quite a bit of cloud cover, so a bit of a grey day tomorrow in the afternoon. And then on Sunday in particular, we've got, again, a bit of a cloudy morning, but by the afternoon a bit more sunshine around, so less so widespread fog and frost for Sunday morning. But then on Monday, things start to change a little bit. We do have a cold front coming through. It'll be in the southwestern parts of the state during the morning and then move eastwards throughout the day and kind of clear the state mostly by the evening period or so. So, look, some lingering showers on and south of the ranges on Monday. But actually, ahead of that, I should probably flag that we will get some perhaps reasonably strong winds in the northwesterlies before the front. So overnight on Sunday and into Monday morning in particular over places like the Otways, perhaps the central ranges and the Bass Coast, kind of Wilson's Prom area, might get a little bit windy and a couple of gusts around there, but nothing significant in terms of severe weather. But, yeah, look, just flagging, there could be a little bit of wind around over that overnight period before Monday and the front comes through. But then after that, from Tuesday onwards, we've kind of just got, once again, another ridge over us in those southwesterly winds. So you can expect cloudy mornings, a couple of showers in the south, and then, you know, really nice sunshine in the north, Warwick.
Yeah. I've been grilling you all week over the future rain prospects for the north. We've given up on that. I do have a text message here, though, Stephanie, saying, when's a big rain coming for the south? How's the south's rain prospects looking?
It's a great question. I can't say that anything's coming in the next week or so, unfortunately. I mean, also, too, if you wanted to have a look at our climate outlooks as well, we've got, you know, some pretty average-looking climate rainfall statistics for the next 1 to 3 months as well, which is a bit unfortunate. But, you know, I mean, we've got those showers on the south of the ranges could bring a couple of mils here and there. It's enough to keep things kind of damp and grey, but unfortunately no significant rainfall, I think, on the horizon just so, like, right now.
And warnings across the weekend. It looks like we've got a sheep graziers for tomorrow in the northeast. Is there much else expected?
Nothing else, really. There could be a bit of wind around on Monday, like we said, so a couple of wind warning over the coast on Monday. But over the weekend, no, just be keeping an eye out for, you know, fog and frost in the week, in the early morning period.
Brilliant. Thanks, Stephanie.
Enjoy your day, Warwick. Thanks so much.
Stephanie Miles there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau with the full weather forecast for you. Plenty of texts coming in. I've been asking you today your favourite farm field day around Australia. Deb in Bendigo says Agfest in Tasmania, by far the best field day I've been to, and it's on next week. Deb, that's cool. That's great information. Thank you very much for that. Never been Agfest. You've got a kindred spirit, if you will, because this one says, was Farmworld used to be the best. They had a lot of hort equipment, but not so much anymore. Much more hobby farmer focused. I guess that's with the people that are around them. The Agfest field days in Tassie are the best, in my opinion. So two votes in terms of Tassie there. Man, a lot of votes. Craig says, was Henty Field Day. Can't beat that song. Catherine from Ballarat. Hi, Was. I've never made it, but have to vote to Henty because of the song. Don't you reckon you could play a little bit of it on today's show? Of course we can, Catherine. Going to the Henty Field Dance. A lot of good people there. See you at the Henty Field Dance. There's nothing like it anywhere. Going to the Henty Field Dance. It is a really good song, isn't it? I quite like the Seymour Alternative Farming Expo jingle as well. That's, you're going to Seymour, show your sons and daughters the way. I won't sing it to you, but we're Australia-wide right now. You can send in a text or give us a call, 1300 977 222 to call, 0467 842 722 to text. What's the best farm field day in Australia? Would love your thoughts on this. Tell us why too. That's the important bit. Tell me why it's your favourite farm field day. 0467 842 722 to do that. Let's keep moving though on the Country Hour. Peak body for the grains industry. Grains growers is calling for an injection of cash to upgrade ageing bridges and get bigger trucks moving on key freight routes. Bigger trucks are currently not permitted on many regional roads because bridges on those routes don't have sufficient load ratings. Annabelle Maxier is a policy manager for trade and supply chains at Grain Growers. She says federal funding currently available for bridges doesn't go far enough.
Look, the federal government has recently announced $20 million in funding for the bridge renewal program, which is a positive start, but it's really a drop in the ocean compared to what we need to fix aging regional bridges. A lot of bridges across Australia were built between 50 and 70 years ago and are coming to the end of their operational life cycle. So we're seeing restrictions on weight limits, even trucks not being able to actually cross some bridges. In some extreme cases, bridges have fallen down in southwest Victoria. So we urgently need funding to be able to ensure that grain freight can move along these critical freight routes and even local roads where farmers need to access their paddocks.
And Annabelle, $20 million might sound like a fair bit of money, but I could imagine perhaps that could be sucked up just on even a couple of larger bridge projects.
Definitely. The scale of bridges that need repairs is eye-watering, actually. Within Victoria, there are approximately 6,000 bridges managed by the Victorian Department of Transport and Planning, and of those, 1,000 have been identified as requiring upgrades. So this has massive implications. At a local council level, 25% of councils don't know the bridge, the weight restrictions on many of their bridges, and 12% don't even know how many bridges they have. So we don't even know how many bridges out there need fixing.
And I imagine that local governments, they're already under pretty significant cost pressures, and I'm assuming they wouldn't have anywhere near the financial resources in their own budgets to fund some of these upgrades.
Definitely. The Grattan Institute's identified that local councils need an extra $1 billion a year in terms of road funding to be able to meet the current standard. One of the examples I really like to give to explain how much pressure local councils are under in regional areas is that the cost of maintaining bridges in urban areas is shared by nearly 5,000 people. And then in rural areas, the cost is shared between less than 142 people. So that puts a lot of pressure on large rural councils in grain-growing areas with small rater bases to be able to maintain extensive road networks.
You're saying we need to upgrade these bridges to facilitate larger trucks. So why is that important to be getting larger trucks, getting routes approved for larger trucks?
This is a massive step that's been identified to improve grain freight efficiency. Currently, it costs $1.2 billion in freight costs to transport grain each year. We can't control the rain and we can't control international markets, but grain freights and supply chain efficiency is one space that we can really play with to improve profitability for growers and ensure that Australia remains competitive in global markets.
And the future is bigger trucks, isn't it? Because already you're seeing not many semi-trailers and B-doubles seeming to be replaced by road trains.
Definitely. B-doubles are now essentially the norm, and we're really looking at the benefits of A-doubles. For they're safer on the roads, they're better in reducing emissions, and they reduce the total amount of truck trips that need to go on the road. So it delivers a huge amount of benefits, not just to the individual growers, but the community as a whole.
One particular example that you've cited on a key freight route is the Western Highway, the link between Melbourne and Adelaide, and it's got a bridge that you say is not fit for purpose for larger trucks.
Definitely. This has been a long-standing bugbear of mine. The Western Highway is the second busiest national highway in Australia in terms of freight movements. It's been approved for 85.5-tonne loads, which sounds fantastic. But the bridge at Dimboola, the weight limit is 73 tonnes. So that effectively reduces the efficiency of grain and the amount of grain that can be moved in single trips, both to South Australia and to the Port of Melbourne.
How much money would you like to be seen specifically allocated for bridge upgrades?
So currently the federal government has flagged that they're actually going to merge the Bridge Renewal Program and the Heavy Vehicle Safety and Productivity Program at the next budget. We want to see out of that $150 million they've allocated, that $100 million is maintained in the budget for aging regional bridge infrastructure, because we can't afford to have bridges forgotten in this new merged program.
The federal budget, the next federal budget is on the horizon. Do you think you'll have any luck in getting what you're asking for?
I think this is a really common sense solution that will not just benefit the grain industry, but road users and the broader freight industry as well. So we'd really like to hope that they can continue to fix a lot of this critical ageing infrastructure.
That is Annabelle McTeer, Policy Manager for Trade and Supply Chain at Grain Growers there. In a statement, the Federal Infrastructure Minister Catherine King said, and I quote, "Our freight and supply chain networks are critical to the national economy, business and communities. That's why I am reviewing the National Freight and Supply Chain Strategy to ensure it can support safe, secure and resilient freight systems and supply chains into the future," end quote. Didn't really address the bridges, but that's what you get sometimes. A couple of your texts in terms of favourite field days around Australia. Sheepvention Rural Expo showcasing Southern Grampian, something for all ages and styles. That's almost a tagline, anonymous texter. Rob Chilton says, Henty, everything is there, and I love the theme song. Sean says, not that it's the best, but I only heard that Colin Stray, who started the Seymour Alternative Farming Expo, passed away a few weeks ago. Although he sold the rights to the expo a few years ago, definitely left a fair legacy with that event. Thanks, Woz, says Sean. And that is true. Sean, there was tributes to Colin Stray up at the Seymour Expo this year. They sold the event, actually, to a regional newspaper, which makes it all the more nice of them that they let us go and do a broadcast from the Alternative Farming Expo the other day, which was great. And you can listen back to that where you get the Victorian Country Hour podcast. If you want to hear about scams in the Pole Highland world or a vetting of miniature goat buyers, what else did we have? We had a lot of discussions about a lot of things. Lowline, a lot of industries around niche and smaller agricultural produce and products. And it was great. It was really, really fun. There were a lot of commercial problems with some of these smaller industries, and they were really open about that. So it's well worth listening. If you want to listen to the Victorian Country Hour podcast, just Google that or get in the ABC Listen app and just search Victorian Country Hour and you'll find it and go from there. Let's take you to the ocean right now on the Country Hour today, though, because this is something you'll be able to watch more on the weekend as well. Pioneering South Australian fishing boat, the Tacoma, has made a return voyage to Port Fairy in Victoria, where it was built by the Haldane brothers, 72 years ago. The boat retired only 9 years ago, which is amazing in itself, and is maintained as a maritime history experience by the Tacoma Preservation Society, taking tourists out of Port Lincoln to fish for bluefin tuna, as the boat did in the 1950s. But what could have been had it stayed here in Victoria instead of going to South Australia? The ABC Eyre Peninsula reporter Jodie Hamilton has been following along the story, where it will be featured on Landline this weekend. Here's a little of that, and here's skipper Ross Haldane explaining the significance of the Port Fairy visit.
Turning to Port Fairy is a historical moment for not only my family, but also for Port Fairy itself, because this is the biggest boat ever built in Port Fairy, and it's part of the DNA of this fishing port. As we approached and we first saw the lighthouse of Port Fairy, Jack and I had a little moment. It was good.
Ross Haldane. 90-year-old Jack Bellamy was aboard the Tacoma to make the return trip to Port Fairy.
Beautiful, come round the point, the lighthouse coming into the Port Fairy, I thought, where she was built here. We'd come back to our old home to show the people of the boat still look like after all these years.
The sight of the Tacoma on the Moyne River brought back memories for Ross's brother Roger Haldane, who lives in Portland.
I remember it was getting decked out. I had a little sailor's hat, and my cousin had a little captain's hat. Yeah, my memories are heading out into the big wide ocean. We were sitting up on deck up alongside the funnel, and it was quite a bad day, like a big roll on. And people I've talked to since, it's all relieving. They're gone through their mind is we'll never see them again. When I saw her anchored out in the bay here, and then she came into the river, and it was just a magic experience to see her coming up there, and all the children there along the bank, chanting there, Tacoma, Tacoma, Tacoma.
Roger Haldane. Andy Haldane spent his working life fishing on the Tacoma and later built boats himself. He was on the banks of the Moyne to see the Tacoma come home at Port Fairy.
Yeah, well, it was pretty emotional because the last we'd ever seen was Fletcher Jones' photos of it disappearing down the river, heading out, and to see it coming actually back in was, after 72 years, was a pretty big deal, you know, emotional. And then to see the amount of people lined up to welcome it was just, you know, blew us away. It's not many boats that come back to their original home ports after 70 years or something. It's such a small port like Port Fairy, it was a big deal.
Andy Haldane. Port Fairy's Trevor Dowie watched the boat leave in 1952.
I can remember it being built and the launch in 52. The day it left, yeah, oh, it was a great sight seeing it going up the Moyne River. Such a big structure for a little kid. It was like the Titanic. going up the river, it seems so big. So I've been very interested in its progress over the years, and its fishing in South Australia. I've remained very interested in what it was up to all the time. Yeah. Oh, I was thinking how good it was to see it again after 72 years. You know, when it came up the river today, I was just gobsmacked. No, it was wonderful. The Titanic was coming home.
Trevor Dowie. But it could have been a different story. The Haldanes ran out of money building the Tacoma, and when the Victorian government wouldn't back them, the South Australian government did, as Roger Haldane explains.
By knocking back my father and his brothers, they were after additional loans to finish the boat, the South Australia stepped in and picked up the baton, and so Victoria literally missed the boat.
The return visit was welcomed by Moyne Deputy Mayor Karen Foster.
For the Tacoma to come home, it was a very big deal for Port Fairy, but for Moyne Shire generally. We absolutely would love the Tacoma to keep coming back here. We have had to dredge the channel a little for it. It has got a draft that's quite deep, this beautiful old vessel. But we would love to see it come back here time and time again. This is its spiritual home, if you like.
Maritime historian Gary Kerr said the return of the Tacoma to Port Fairy was a significant event.
Tacoma's right up there amongst the most important heritage vessels in Australia. Not only can you go aboard and see, you can actually go to sea on her. She's been beautifully maintained, and she's quite unique in that regard, in as much as most vessels have hard times before anyone realises they should have been kept. But the Haldanes had enough vision to know that when she was retired from professional fishing, to keep her going, to keep her as an example of the fishery of the 1950s. It was wonderful to see her coming up the river today, back to her home port where she was born 72 years ago. I was getting a bit emotional. I had to get my hanky out.
That's maritime historian Gary Kerr ending that story from Jodie Hamilton, with additional reporting from Ian Doyle, and the bagpipes playing there, or playing a Scottish tribute to welcome boats back to port. You can see that story on Landline this weekend, or catch up on ABC iView while you're at it. You can just watch it again after you watch it on the telly. That's a good thing to do. You're listening to The Country Hour. A couple of texts just quickly on bridges and the state of them, as we heard from grain growers earlier. Sharon says, it's not just bridges. We have culverts in our area failing. The trucks are bigger, carrying heavier loads more often. And this other text says, well, maybe they could go another step and do something about rail while they're at it as well. Debates we've had before, debates we will have again. I promise you that on The Country Hour. Hey, I'll just point to next week on The Country Hour. Actually, Monday's program will have a special interview for you with probably one of the most famous young farmers, if not the most famous young farmer in the world right now. Caleb Cooper is the contractor that does a lot of work on Clarkson's Farm, a hit TV show where British celebrity Jeremy Clarkson tries to run a farm for profit. It's been credited with doing more for the industry in that country, that show, than just about anything else, highlighting the plight of farmers and the difficulties they face in making money as well. And I caught up with Caleb. That interview will go to air on Monday to talk about how he got to where he is, his thoughts on farming, and some of the things we get to see on the show too.
I think every farmer has a different idea on how to make money to save the farm, maybe, or even just make sure things tick over. So therefore, the ideas are obviously amazing to keep highlighting, and all these ideas, people may go, that actually worked, I'm going to try that on my farm. And of course, seasons change. You know, we've had an incredibly wet winter. I mean, we've had more rain here than anyone's ever seen before. I mean, I think it's the wettest on record. And so, of course, you have all these different problems then. If it's wet in the autumn and the spring, you can't drill. So therefore, we're only just getting our spring barley and our spring crops in for this year. Well, we're incredibly late. They should have gone in a month ago. So, of course, you've got them issues then to highlight as well. And I think obviously me and Jeremy obviously have all these ideas, and some majority of the ideas I have work, and the ideas that he has are total crap.
Well, you're up for a promotion this season, aren't you? I saw that in the promo.
I'm farm manager now.
Does that mean he lets you make decisions?
Well, I've been thinking about this, and I'm sure I've been farm manager for the last 5 years. So therefore, this is a touchy subject, okay? But you know what? I'm not going to turn down a promotion. I'm not going to turn down the promotion, but come on.
That's Caleb Cooper, the full interview coming to you on the Country Hour on Monday. He's only about 25. And he's telling this old fella what to do on a farm. And he's actually the conscience, right? Like the good advice, good farming advice that you hear on that program. It's a really interesting discussion about how he got into agriculture, how it's taught him a lot, and really what it's like farming on a hit TV show and then going back season after season for more. Hope you can join us then. I hope you can have a great weekend as well, and we'll be back soon to do it all again. Remember, you can always get the Victorian Country Hour as a podcast. Catch up.